my bucket list, I've got Australia for sure. India, definitely Africa, but no specific country.
Most definitely Japan, and I think also the USA.
Machu Picchu, Tokyo, and I think Alaska.
I would love to see Portugal and Morocco.
Brazil.
I would like to see Egypt, Greece, and Spain.
Well, if I could, I would visit New Zealand and Switzerland.
That's just a couple of the responses we got when we asked people here in the streets of Bonn about their travel bucket list. And it takes us straight into our final episode of our tourism and travel special here with On the Green Fence, DW's environment podcast. I'm Neil King, and in this episode, I'll be exploring just why do we have these bucket lists in the first place? What is it that drives us to travel? Particularly against the backdrop of the growing climate crisis, with the tourism industry contributing a whopping estimated 8% of the world's greenhouse gases. But before we talk to a travel sociologist about why we feel the need to travel and how that might be changing, let's just hear how people here in the street answered that seemingly, well, rather simple question, isn't it? Why do you travel?
Because I have got the feeling that this could take me far in my life and my expansion, and I think I could learn a lot.
I think it's the feeling of feeling lost, and that I really miss for the travel, especially Tokyo. Like, I don't know the language, I've never been, and I would feel completely lost. And it makes you realize that not everything is under your control that easily, and you need to adapt. And especially if you've always been in Europe, where it's easy in the end to connect with people and the areas, going far away makes you realize not everything is like at home.
Beautiful nature, interesting culture, and in general, just a lot to see there, interesting people.
Because of the beaches and the culture, and I think I'd like to see another culture than the one we are used to here in Western European countries.
I think it's super important to see nature a lot and to visit big places. I don't know, it's just, I'm very sensitive to that, and it's, I think we maybe tend to be used to live in cities too much and don't realize that we need to see green and trees and that we need it for our self-balance, actually.
Okay, so we got an inkling of some of the motives for traveling there. Personally, I'm probably the nature traveler. I like to go to spots, you know, and immerse myself in nature. But what do the experts say on this? Is there something that runs deeper that is compelling us to see the world? And again, especially since we know that flying, for instance, is contributing to the climate crisis. So let's bring in Richard Sharpley here. He's a professor of tourism and development at the University of Central Lancashire in Preston, England. And I got in touch with him to get the sociological angle. And I started out by asking him, well, pretty much what we asked the people in the street. Why do we travel?
It's a really interesting question, and I think it's a question that nobody has really been able to find a definitive answer to yet. Certainly in the early days of what became mass tourism or mass travel, the key drivers have always been money, time and technology. In other words, as soon as we've had the ability both financially and temporally to travel and the means to do so through trains, aeroplanes, cars, we have done so. There's an intrinsic desire, I believe, amongst most people to explore our planet, to travel. Some people call it dromomania, you know, a love of crossing roads, of going to new places. And in a sense, I think we've almost been conditioned to become tourists, to engage in tourism during the year at particular times, to the extent that I think a lot of people become tourists and engage in tourism without actually considering why they're doing so.
I mean, that conditioning process, who is pushing that? Is it a clever marketing ploy by the tourism industry? Or why is that happening? Is it peer pressure? What is it?
I think it's a combination of both, to be honest. I think it's recognition of that the people have this need to get away. There's this sense in modern society that somehow we will find a better existence, we will find ourselves, we will find something different. We'll find happiness by going on holiday. And that's the kind of intrinsic belief that is being created. That is partly, I think, as what I mentioned before, this desire of human beings to be somewhere else, to escape, to discover our world. But it's also a combination of very clever marketing on the part of the travel sector, imploring us to, you know, spend our money on holidays.
There's also this aspect, isn't it, that we all strive to be as cosmopolitan as possible, right? So that in a way, if you haven't been to certain places, you know, you almost have the reputation that you haven't lived in certain circles. I mean, how strong a role does that play, do you think, this sort of...
I think that varies. I mean, there are plenty of people, there are lots of tourists who will go to the same place every year, year on year, because they're comfortable, they're familiar with it. To them, tourism is a means of relaxation, of literally of recreation, recreation. And they don't wish to be unchallenged and are quite happy to go to their apartment on the Algarve or wherever it might be every year. On the other hand, there are increasing numbers of people, I believe, and I guess it's manifested in the increasing popularity of the so-called bucket list, that in a sense, collecting places is part of identity formation. It becomes one aspect of how people see themselves and identify themselves against others. It's the people who accidentally let their passport pages be visible at the airport so you can see all the stamps in it. It's sort of a superiority kind of thing if you've travelled more than anybody else. Participation in tourism is becoming an increasingly complex sociological phenomenon because it's part of identity, it's part of leisure. And in this era of social media, that kind of identity role has been enhanced in the modern time, I think.
This social media aspect, I mean, that's something I also find fascinating and disturbing at the same time. The fact that, I mean, on the one hand, a lot of people just like to show off and, you know, tick off that bucket list, as you said. They travel to, in mass tourism, there are many destinations that people, they're just in and out in one day just to take that one selfie. How big a role does this sort of this bucket list mentality and this fear of missing out? Do you see that role growing also post-pandemic when people are itching to travel again and get that bucket list sorted?
I'm not convinced fear of missing out, or FOMO as they call it, is such a great driver of tourism. Certainly, though, I think the whole role of social media and the ability to go on social media through Instagram or Facebook or whatever it is and tell people and share your experiences, you know, is a key driver. And it's not a concern as such, but what to me it is doing is transforming the nature of the tourist experience in a negative sense. In the past, you know, we travelled in the spirit of adventure, in the spirit of the unknown. These days, yeah, it's possible to travel in almost perfect knowledge. You can check out where you're going to stay, what you're going to eat, where you're going to go and see, you know, online before you go. And you can share that instantaneously. In my view, people are experiencing less and less the places they are. They might be there in body, but not necessarily in mind, because a lot of people are constantly thinking, how am I going to present myself to my social media group back home through my posts on Facebook or Instagram or wherever it might be? And this has actually been referred, I've actually done a small piece on it myself, a concept of nowstalgia as opposed to nostalgia. In other words, people are recording themselves and on holiday, almost in the expectation of having future nostalgic experiences. So it's changing the whole role of tourism in people's minds, I think.
Would you say that awareness about the environment or sustainability is changing the way we travel?
No. The quick answer is no. This is the great challenge for the future of tourism, I think, within the context of a particular global warming and environmental change more generally. You know, can we change the way we travel, or more particularly, my belief is we need to reduce the amount we travel. A lot of research has been done into the extent to which tourists are willing to adapt their behaviour as tourists, you know, to travel in a slightly different way, to behave in a different way. And there's something unique about tourism in as much as even those people who regularly consume or behave in an environmentally friendly fashion, you know, whether it's what they buy, whether they recycle, whether they cycle instead of driving, or whatever it might be, but those people still go on holiday. And research has found that they actually temporarily forget their environmental credentials, that they, you know, they behave like, inverted commas, normal tourists. You know, it's been shown that they do suffer some kind of eco-guilt, but nevertheless, they continue to travel, they continue to fly. Travel is now seen as a right, not as a privilege. It's long been my view that the only way to achieve any kind of change in behaviour, consumer behaviour in general, and in tourism in particular, it will be through regulation and pricing.
What kind of regulation do you envisage? You know, if you were to...
Well, the regulations would be... I mean, I certainly do envisage, and I think a lot of people in the airline sector do envisage a significant rise in the cost of air travel, becoming more of a luxury again in the future. I don't see a long-term future for low-cost travel. You know, I question whether people are actually going to come to question, you know, why they engage in travel so much. I'm young enough, or sorry, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, tourism was just the summer holiday, and you would look forward to those 2 weeks a year when you would go on holiday, and it was distinctive, it was special, it was meaningful. Whereas nowadays, it is so easy to travel. When you can travel all the time, in my view, it loses the excitement, it loses its meaning. And I'm just wondering, also combined with this so-called over-tourism phenomenon, that people are actually going to be thinking, well, actually, you know, I don't want to fly to Barcelona to share Las Ramblas with 6 million other people. You know, I'm spending money and it's not really much fun anymore, and it's just collecting places, and, you know, why am I doing it? Yeah. It's almost as though, I've used the term, you know, obesity of experience. And I think, you know, particularly in Europe and elsewhere, actually, but, you know, we are becoming obese on experiences. And I think people eventually may begin to realise that, you know, to really enjoy tourism, let's do it a bit less, you know, and really savour it when we do travel.
I love that turn of phrase, the obesity of experience. I think that's just fantastic. But at the same time, if we're looking at perhaps some of the critics of what you're saying, if we look at, you know, sort of a very liberally minded, globalized person who sort of thinks that the market regulates all and everything will be fine. And for them, this could sound like socialist police state that's bordering on an eco-dictatorship. I mean, what do you say to them?
Well, yeah, no, I completely understand that. I'm as up to a point as in favour of a neoliberal democratic country economy, you know, where everybody has freedoms to do what they want to do, to be who they want to be and spend what they want to spend. We certainly in the developed world, we've all benefited very heavily from that. And tourism is just one of many, many things we consume on a regular basis that we enjoy. And it's all part of this growth-based neoliberal economy, which is, you know, understood as driving progress, development, happiness, and so on and so forth. I mean, I'd be the first to acknowledge that actually tourism, economically and in a developmental sense, is a you know, quote unquote, a very good thing. There are numerous destinations, societies, countries around the world which are entirely dependent upon tourism. Arguably, we need to overall consume less to achieve this balance, mm-hmm. Across the world, to achieve equity and justice. And certainly tourism is one thing where there is no justice and no equity, because it is environmentally a very destructive activity enjoyed by, particularly international tourism, enjoyed by a relatively small proportion of the global population.
One other aspect here, I mean, do you also see, because if we're looking ahead, that we're going to have to change and, I mean, also, you know, maybe introduce a kind of degrowth model on various levels. I mean, what about the generational justice here? I mean, we've got the Fridays for Future movement who are sort of standing up for their future. But, I mean, there are also mm-hmm. other youths who will say, you know, great, you know, my parents, they had a blast while tourism was great and they could go everywhere they wanted and globetrotted. And now I'm supposed to sort of stop traveling, stop doing what my parents did. Do you see any sort of rifts within society, also within the younger generation, over this?
Yeah, I mean that's a really good question, actually. And the whole youth movement in terms of the environment, you know, is very much based on the argument that, you know, the young people's parents, you know, my generation and my parents' generation, you know, we're the ones who have, on the one hand, had, you know, enjoyed very rapid improvements in our standard of living. But at the same time, we're the generations who, through that creation of wealth and enjoying ourselves so much, has actually underpinned the destruction of the global environment. And yes, undoubtedly, there will be resentment on the part of younger generations who might believe in one way or another their freedoms, their opportunities have been curtailed through the activities of the older generation. But I think also the younger generation are sufficiently aware to realise that actually if they were to continue in the way that early generations have behaved, then they won't have a world to live in.
It just strikes me that, you know, listening to everything you just said, that the momentum or the impulse for humanity to strive for wealth, to grow, to expand, to gather, to collect, it's just so strong. How hopeful are you that we're going to stop this huge momentum that is building up also in developed countries, right, to grow, to expand, and rein things back to a sustainable level?
I'm not hopeful, to be honest. I think the belief in the capitalist neoliberal model of development and economic growth is so ingrained in everything. You know, there's no such thing as sustainable growth. You know, that was said 20, 30 years ago. And people continue to recognize that sustainable growth is an oxymoron, it's a contradiction in terms. I think there's too much belief in the ability of humankind to find technological reasons to solve all these problems, that, you know, that there will be solutions through technology to decouple production and growth from environmental destruction. I'm not hopeful, actually, which again is a little bit depressing, but that's the way it is.
Richard Sharpley, Professor of Tourism and Development at the University of Central Lancashire. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. It's been great to talk to you.
So given what Richard Sharpley said there, which ended on a somewhat bleak outlook, I thought it might be interesting to hear from people how they feel about the environmental impact their travel is having when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. We know that tourism contributes to an estimated 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And Richard said environmental awareness is not changing the way we travel. We just feel more guilty about it. But just how guilty do people really feel about their trips? Again, we took to the streets of Bonn to find out.
Honestly, I do not think about these environmental issues that much in vacation. Yeah,
I don't fly at all anymore since 1 year. And really think if I travel, it's like I plan it ahead and I save money if I have to. And it's going to be a big time because I want to travel in a way that's good, I don't know, for the environment.
I would travel once a year. I wouldn't fly every weekend. I think it's a thing of measure and not so much of guilt.
What is the reason I'm going there? Like, if it's only for pure tourism, yes, I would feel guilty. If I'm going there for working in a long term or like volunteering, I would feel that it would make sense for me to do it and in a way justifies my flight, although it really doesn't. But so far, I think it's the only way to go to another continent. Technically, it's the easiest is the flight.
Okay, so a very mixed bag there with complete opposites. And given just how differently people responded to the question of travel guilt, we really wanted to talk to a travel psychologist about what happens in our heads when we travel and whether there really is as little hope of our behaviour changing as the sociologist Richard Sharpley suggested. So we decided to talk to Kevin Moore, who's an associate professor in psychology and tourism on the other side of the world at Lincoln University in Christchurch, New Zealand. And I started out by asking him whether we are experiencing growing eco-guilt and how this is going to impact on our psyche and our behaviour in the long run.
I think these things definitely are changing. There is, you know, I mean, there's been lots of evidence that people's both environmental awareness but also behaviours have been changing over the past few decades. And I think there's also definitely been changes in people's social and cultural sort of values and attitudes more broadly. So in relation to travel, yes, I think we are reflexive beings. You know, we think about what we do, and it puts people in cognitive dissonance. And it's perhaps sometimes for the more ethically sensitive, an even greater bind than that. So it puts us in quite a dilemma, I think, and that's part, I suppose, of the human condition. You know, there's always obligations and awareness which pulls us in different directions. That might be another sort of lever, because we are moral beings, you know. It's part of our social existence. We are concerned about what others think about us. But on the other hand, people also don't like being told what to do. So that's the opposite side of the coin.
I guess, I mean, there's also this part of, you know, this fear of missing out, I think, is also very strong. Also, when I think, you know, I've got three kids, if I were to deprive them now of travel and not show them other countries, I'd feel like a bad parent, because you grow so much when you bring them to different places, different languages, different people, different cultures. There's so much to get out of it. So it's something, it'd be very hard for me to take away from my children.
Well, that's exactly. I mean, that's an interesting example of where the ethical or the moral aspect of our being sort of works to encourage travel, because, you know, like say as parents, people know that there's this big global world, and to a certain extent, you know, it's coming to all of us anyway, even if we don't travel away. But the sense that for us all to get on, we need to raise our children in a way that they're aware of the world and its variety and the like, and the different people, the different environments. Absolutely, you know, I mean, I think more and more people, particularly of the, you know, sort of educated middle classes, will choose destinations partly, you know, on that basis, if they have children, partly on the basis of, well, you know, this will be good for my child to experience or to see. And yeah, it's if we want a fully integrated global world, it's hard to see how travel isn't an aspect of that.
But seriously, Richard, as a psychologist, would you say that we need travel to lead a full and happy life?
We can have, and humans have had, perfectly fulfilling lives without being able to travel to the other side of the globe. And also, I think working with that awareness that if you do travel, perhaps you don't need to travel so far, so fast, go to so many places all in such a short amount of time. There's the whole movement now we talk about of slow travel or slow tourism,
right,
which comes out of the slow food movement and the like. And the idea there is all about, firstly, you know, all the transport would be much more sort of low carbon, if you like. You know, when you're in a region, you might use bicycles or public transport or whatever. But also that you connect with the place. So you spend longer in a smaller area rather than rapidly moving over large distances and the like. So, and part of the argument there is that not only is it environmentally friendly, but it's also experientially, it can be much more satisfying and much deeper. You can have just as interesting and just as rewarding a life, frankly, even if you never travel. It's perfectly possible. It's not that you're missing out or losing something in terms of your well-being. I know my grandmother never went beyond about 50 miles from her place of birth in England until she travelled by plane to New Zealand to see her relatives who'd migrated out there, perfectly happy and living a perfectly fine life. Many people report how rewarding it is when they feel like they have connected with a place or with a people. And I think that serves a very deep human need, which is to feel, you know, part of the world rather than alienated from it.
If we look at now a bit more closely, I mean, it's the period probably isn't long enough to do any sort of, you know, or have any conclusive scientific study on this yet. But since the pandemic has hit us, right, and we've been in and out of lockdowns and tourism has ground to a halt, what opportunity is this for us to reset travel? Is this going to help us, you know, push these levers towards more sustainability, or is it actually going to be more of an obstacle because as soon as we get the go-ahead, the floodgates are just going to open and we're going to go crazy because we're starved of travel?
Yes, well, that's the big question. And I just reiterate that, yes, it is an opportunity. And the interesting thing, I think, certainly here in New Zealand, is that there's been an upsurge in domestic tourism. And I think the awareness of what can be done more locally, for example, could really be leveraged to dampen sort of the really environmentally damaging forms of international travel. So, in other words, people will spend more of their time actually exploring the places which are closer, which are, you know, part of, you know, either their country or their region. And I think if that can, because people have become aware that that's a possibility, and it's actually, you know, there are things which they didn't realise were there and enjoyable experiences which could be had. So that is certainly an opportunity to try to just reconstruct our expectations around travel, particularly international travel, and that maybe it becomes once again a rarer thing, you know, something that, you know, we might do once every 5 to 10 years rather than, you know, 2 to 3. And if that can happen, and if policy can, you know, make it actually rewarding to live in this sort of less expansive way, then, yeah, I think there is hope there, if you like, of a more sustainable form of travel overall. And it's certainly at the level of individuals, you know, because individuals will have experienced that actually life doesn't suddenly become bleak and meaningless if I can't suddenly hop on a plane and go to another continent. It can still be quite fulfilling.
Kevin, thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it. It was very interesting, taking away a lot from this.
Yeah, well, it's as you can tell, I like to talk about these things, and it's been good to talk to you, and it's some very good questions. And I think we all need to think about them a lot more.
Thanks, Kevin. Take care. All the best.
Okay. See you later.
Bye. Right. Time to summarise. What are the main takeaways for me personally? Well, I'm going to have to start with Richard's phrase, the obesity of experience. That's really going to stick with me. This bucket list mentality of ticking off destinations in your lifetime is something, well, we've all got, I guess, and to a certain degree, we've been conditioned to travel, as Richard said. But maybe, you know, we should reconsider how we tick off that list and perhaps also swap some of the destinations for ones that are closer and perhaps less ambitious to reach. Personally, I also feel that this whole social media hype is something we should really tone down. I don't want to insult anyone out there, but jetting in and out of places for that selfie or snap to show off to your followers, you know, I mean, really? Is that what it's about? Anyway, also, as Kevin, the psychologist, said very clearly, we don't need to travel to lead a happy life. And I really loved that anecdote about his granny who never travelled any more than 50 miles from her place of birth. Of course, you might say those were different times, but still, I think this aspect is sometimes neglected and perhaps worth reintroducing into our mindset to a certain degree, that we can just slow down, we don't have to go so far, just take it easy. But also, having said that, of course, I want to show my kids the world as a parent, and I would like to see them engage with other cultures, etc. But at the same time, maybe it's enough to have a handful of longer and more intensive trips abroad that are meaningful, you know, to achieve this, rather than an annual summer holiday where you have trouble cramming everything in to the, you know, there's so much you want to do. You've only got a limited amount of time, and the destinations are often overcrowded. And also, against the backdrop of the pandemic, this has certainly made me personally appreciate my home country even more than I already did. There's still so much here to explore without me having to go far and wide, wrecking the environment with my travel. So personally, I would really love to hike from Germany's most southern point to its most northern point, for instance. But I would need a rather long break for that. So that would be very much slow travel, something that Kevin was also keen on, which I find really interesting. It's a great concept. But it's also something that requires time. And for anyone who is working a full-time job with school kids, like myself, for instance, who needs to spread out the holiday over the year, you know, this can be rather tricky. So maybe reshaping tourism and travel needs to go hand in hand with reshaping our work environment and also our working hours. Maybe we should really start working less all round. And for all those employers out there who are now sort of throwing their arms up and say, what's he talking about? I mean, think about this in terms of productivity and creativity. I think employers could also benefit if they have happier and more relaxed workers who've been able to take a nice, long and sustainable break. Just a thought. But please do let us know what you think on this. You can send us an email to onthegreenfence@dw.com. Time to wrap up our tourism and travel series. I'm afraid we didn't resolve the dilemma we all face when it comes to tourism and the environment. But I do hope that we gave you some ideas as to how we can improve things a little bit and also reduce our footprint in this world. In our next episode of On the Green Fence, we'll be kicking off a series on cars and the changes that are happening in this huge sector. It's an industry that is really quite crucial in so many ways, not just for Germany, but across the globe. So please do join me again for that. In the meantime, you can find lots of other interesting environment stories on our website. Just go to dw.com/environment. We also have some great environment videos on our YouTube and Instagram channels. Just check out DW Planet A on YouTube or DW Global Ideas on Instagram for that. Time to thank my colleague and producer Natalie Muller, who made this series work behind the scenes, and my sound engineer Jürgen Kuhn. And thank you to all of you out there for listening in and rating us on Apple Podcasts. We really do appreciate that. My name is Neil King. Bye for now. Take it easy and take care.